Edutainment Learning is powered by Academica Virtual Education and Collegia TV. For more information, visit www.edutainmentlearning.com.
Well, my name is Daniel DiMartino, and I am originally from Venezuela. I am currently in New York City, where I live and study and work. And as you may know, Venezuela is a country in the north of South America that has seen a lot of problems lately that is very much in the news. And so I just wanted to, I came here to tell you all about why I came to the United States, what's going on in Venezuela, and why the story of Venezuela really matters to you. And so let me begin by quoting actually from a book. The book is called Venezuela, Land of Opportunity, and it was published in 1956. Just to make sure everybody can hear me all right, right? Good. So it says, Venezuela today is experiencing a wave of economic development similar to that in the United States at the turn of the century. This should in no wise be construed as meaning that Venezuela lies 50 years behind the United States. What is meant is that the opportunity and reward for investment is as attractive in Venezuela today as it was 50 years ago in the United States, when corporate and personal income taxes did not stifle individual enterprise. Just for perspective, when this book was written, Venezuela was the fourth richest country in the world. Yet, what I'm going to show you today, and I'm going to share my screen, is how the once fourth richest country in the world is now actually one of the poorest. So let me see how I can do this. Okay. And so let me show you first. This is one of the last pictures I took while living in Venezuela. I was 18 years old, and that was me in a movie theater with the equivalent in cash of a movie ticket. That is how much a movie ticket cost. And so I'm talking about more cash than you can fit in your pocket just to buy an entry at a movie theater. And this was a picture at a grocery store. When we're talking about what happened in Venezuela, you wonder, how does a country that 50 years prior was the fourth richest country in the world become a country where people can't afford a movie ticket or there's no food in the grocery stores? And not only that, but I'm not sure if you're aware, but Venezuela is the country with the largest oil reserves on the planet. That's part of why it was so rich. You know, like the same reason why Dubai is such a wealthy city, or Kuwait and those Arab countries. Well, this is a line in the street in Caracas for gasoline. The country with the most oil in the planet has no gasoline available for its population. And this is another line, but not for gasoline, but for people who want to leave the country. This is the Simon Bolivar Bridge between Colombia and Venezuela in our border. And these are all Venezuelans trying to leave. In fact, Venezuela today is the largest refugee crisis in the planet. There are more Venezuelan refugees than there are Ukrainian or Syrian refugees abroad. However, you'd wonder, what is the war that's happening in Venezuela? Is there any war happening? In Syria, the population is being bombed by Russia, by its own government. They're using chemical weapons against them. There's terrorism. In Ukraine, there's an invasion from Russia, and there's a war going on, and that's why people are escaping. But in Venezuela, there is no war. In Venezuela, the only thing there is a regime that has imposed its will on the population, and that regime is a socialist regime. And so going back to what Venezuela used to be like, this is a picture of the boat in which one of my grandfathers came to Venezuela in 1956, the year that book that I read to you a paragraph from was published. This is the Veracruz vessel. It came from northern Spain, and it came to Venezuela with pioneer immigrants, because Venezuela received the equivalent of 20% of its population in a matter of 10 years in immigrants in the 1950s. And this is a picture of Caracas, back when Caracas, by the way, in the 60s, had more cars per capita than New York City. There is more cars per person. And in the right, the man in the right of those three is my grandfather. When he arrived to Venezuela, he had just finished sixth grade. He was left orphaned in Spain because his father died in the Spanish Civil War, which happened between 1936 and 1939 before World War II. And he started working at 13 years old in Spain at a candy factory and then giving out newspapers. So when his father passed away, when he was, a baby, and his mother remarried and had more children, he basically had to also help provide for the family. And so that's why he worked. And ultimately, he left as the older brother to send remittances back to Spain. And Venezuela was a prosperous country in which to save money and send help back home. My other grandfather, he immigrated from Italy and he became a shoemaker, like most Italians. And he was making shoes by hand. This is him at 17 in Caracas, making shoes. And so this is more recent pictures back from 2009, when I was 10 years old. I'm the little boy in the white shirt in the middle there, and the one on the right. And that's my family. And that's who, I had a beautiful childhood because I had a family that loved me and really a lot of opportunities thanks to all the hard work of my grandparents and my parents. And my parents were able to go to college despite their parents not even finishing high school. And that was the generational jump in Venezuela from a generation that was half of it illiterate, really, to a generation that was college educated. In one generation, it didn't take two or three, it took one generation. And all of that changed, though, over my lifespan. And when I'm talking change, I'm not talking that we just became poorer, 10% poorer or 20% poorer. I'm talking that my parents went from making $3,000-$4,000 a month in the early 2000s to making $100 a month in 2016. And this was my last picture when I was leaving Venezuela for the final time in the airport in Caracas. And so you'd wonder, and I'm going to stop sharing here, what cost the richest country in the world to go from a nation of immigrants to a nation of refugees? What cost the country with the largest oil reserves to squander that great opportunity and wealth and not turning into the next Dubai, right, and the next futuristic nation? And what happened was a socialist government took over. And three policies are to blame for the current crisis in Venezuela. And I'm going to explain why. One is nationalizations. And this means the government took over companies. That is, if you owned, say, a bank or you owned a farm, the government would come and say, this is not yours anymore. Now we're going to manage it. And here's some money that is not at all the price of your company. And some people just didn't get any compensation. What happens is that, imagine if you don't own your company anymore, right? Or let me give you an example. Could any of you raise your hand if you guys have sold things or had any business, traded things for a living? Or yeah, I don't know. Have you guys sold things at school?
Any sales?
It's fine if you unmute yourselves or.
You guys can put your thumbs up. We have security features in here because it's open to the public.
Oh, okay.
So it's safe to say that people have.
Yeah, let's say. I didn't know that they were restricted from doing things. So what is your goal when you're selling something? You want to make money. How do you make money? You have to sell something more expensive at a higher price than what you bought it or what it cost you to produce it. If it costs you, I don't know, $10 to make a pencil case, you're not going to sell it for $9, right? You have to sell it for more. And so that your goal as a private business owner is to reduce costs and increase revenue. That's how you make the most profit. How do you do that? Well, you make the production more efficient. You try to advertise your product. You try to make it higher quality so that people will like it. You try to produce more so that you can sell more. But if the government owns a company, their goal is not profit. In a democracy, their goal is getting votes. How do you get votes? You get votes not by increasing revenue and decreasing cost, but by doing the exact opposite. You get votes by hiring more people than you need, by paying them higher wages than they are, you know, actually producing, by reducing the price of the product the company sells so that you are standing for the poor, right? And you're hiring people for the government company and giving, creating jobs. But the consequence is that all the companies that the government took over went bankrupt because they all were operating at a loss. And so milk processing factories stopped processing milk. Farms stopped cultivating crops and say banks stopped lending. And so the economy gradually decayed. But not everything was taken over by the government. Most small businesses were not. And those, the government, what they did was that as a consequence of their increased welfare spending in public housing, in hiring more government employees, in all the, you know, free gasoline, free utilities, free food, free healthcare and education, all that money, the government didn't have enough to pay for all those things. And so they had to print money from the central bank, causing inflation. And when inflation came, the government blamed the business owners for the inflation rather than its own policies. And by blaming the business owners, they said that we're going to now tell them how much they can charge for their products. So a bakery could not charge more than the government set amount for bread. And the consequence was that bakeries stopped selling bread. They only sold cakes. And then they controlled cakes, and so they stopped selling cakes. And so those controls went on and on for every product you can imagine. And as a consequence, we had to line up for food. When I was in high school, my teacher sometimes would dismiss class because the cashier that was a friend of theirs would call them from the supermarket and tell them that, hey, there's chicken available today that hadn't been available for several days. And the teacher, to provide for their family, of course, dismissed class. We are left without an education. And that is just the least. Now, imagine you are the one who has to go to do the line. That happened to me too. The government started rationing the things that were available, the few things that were available as a result of their policies. And the rationing sometimes worked by day of the week. So based on my ID number, I could only go to the grocery store Mondays and Saturdays. Imagine if you're told you cannot go to Walmart or to Kroger or to whatever grocery store you have, except on a government allowed day. Not just that, but this became high tech communism, I call it, because they set up fingerprint machines in the grocery stores and pharmacies, such that you would have to put your fingerprint in the scanner so that they can verify your identity. And then the machine will tell the cashier how much food and medicines you can buy for that week or that month. I'm talking about dystopian rationing. And this is what we live through. And so that's why millions of people leave Venezuela. And the consequence, and why I began with that presentation that says how socialism destroyed Venezuela. You'd wonder, why are you calling this socialism then? Well, because socialism, this is a self-declared socialist regime, they call their policies socialism of the 21st century. Certainly in technology of rationing, it's certainly socialism of the 21st century. But I call it that because that's what Marx prescribed. Karl Marx, who wrote the Communist Manifesto alongside Engels, if you can read it, it shows that the main tenet of a socialist economy is government-operated and owned means of production. The government took over the companies. The government was operating the means of production. And the means of production that were not government-owned were effectively government-controlled through price controls, through regulations. And so this was a socialist economy. And profit was demonized. Capitalism was demonized. And so nobody invested because nobody, you know, knew if their company was going to be taken over by the government. So let me continue sharing the screen so that you can see this. And so between the nationalizations, the price and currency controls, and the massive deficit spending, our economy was destroyed. And to show Venezuela was truly an incredible example and case study for how, what happens when a country goes from being extremely capitalist to extremely socialist. And that is because in 1970, Venezuela was 10th in the world in economic freedom. That is how, you know, the economic freedom index measures if the government is a small government, if it, you know, has little debt, if low taxes, little regulation, free trade. And so if you're higher in the ranking, you're a freer economy. Venezuela was 10th in the world. By 2021, it was 165th out of 166 countries. So the second least free. There's no better experiment than this. However, there's a lot of people who blame the other things for what happened to Venezuela. The first one is they say, oh, this is just the fault of the United States because of US sanctions. However, that's not true. And I can assure you that most of the Venezuelan population supports US sanctions. And we support it because the sanctions are not actually against the population. The sanctions are simply prohibitions and freezings of bank accounts on government officials, on people who have stolen our wealth, on people who have destroyed our country and killed thousands of Venezuelans in protests and, you know, for democracy. These people lost their bank accounts. That is nothing that affects me or my family or any of my friends because we are not government crooks. However, there are some sanctions. For example, the United States does not import oil from Venezuela directly. Now that's changed with the Biden administration, but that was the main sanction. And so the critics say that this is because the America is blocking Venezuela. However, to that I respond, Cuba is under the same sanctions and Iran is under the same sanctions too. In fact, Iran has such strong sanctions that you can't even send a piece of mail to Iran. To Venezuela, you can send food, you can send medicine, you can buy things from Venezuelans, sell things to Venezuelans. The only thing you can't is sell them to the government. However, why aren't there millions of people fleeing Iran? Iran is not only sanctioned by the US government much more strongly than Venezuela, but Iran is also an oil-dependent country. So it's not, you know, because of the oil industry or something. And Iran is a totalitarian religious regime. Recently, a couple of 20-something-year-olds, a man, you know, a boy and a girl, they were dancing in the street, and they are in prison because they filmed themselves dancing in the street. That was their crime. That doesn't happen in Venezuela. You can dance in the street all you want. You can film yourself all you want. There's not that level of oppression yet. But why aren't there then millions of Iranians crossing the borders to Turkey or some other country that is better off? Because in Iran, people are not starving to death. Iran respects private property because Iran is not a socialist government. And that is not to say that living in Iran is a great thing, but it's certainly not as bad as living in Venezuela. And the difference is not that Venezuela was sanctioned by the United States. Iran was much more. The difference is that Venezuela is socialist, and that's what destroyed us. It was not U.S. sanctions. It was not corruption. It was not that we're dependent on oil. And this is what's happening. Here in the United States, sometimes you see homeless people, most of whom have mental health issues. In Venezuela, you will see homeless families that are perfectly capable mentally and able-bodied because their full-time jobs don't allow them to even eat. And so they go to the trash to eat, full families with their children. I'm just wondering, why does this matter to you? It matters to you because Venezuela, let me stop sharing here. Venezuela is the only country in the world that went and applied socialist policies by electing its way into socialism. Venezuelans voted for Hugo Chavez, the dictator that began all of this in 1999, the year I was born, 24 years ago. And so this did not happen in Cuba. If Fidel Castro rose to power in a revolution, a violent revolution. In the USSR, there was a violent revolution too, and a civil war. In China, there was a civil war, millions of deaths. In the Eastern Pact countries, Warsaw Pact in Eastern Europe, they were invaded by the USSR. They didn't vote for the communists, but Venezuela voted for Chavez. Now they can't vote their way out because there's no democracy anymore. They get in through votes, but the only way out is through bullets. And so this is applicable to us because the United States is not going to suffer a military coup that is going to turn us into a socialist government, but we could vote our way to a socialist government. And that's why that's important. And so why is this a risk? You say, Daniel, nobody wants that in the United States. Well, that's what they told us too. In Venezuela, we were told Venezuela will never be like Cuba. We're not an island, we're a rich country, we're a democracy, we can never be like Cuba. I know we are worse than Cuba, but it's true, we're not an island, so people can escape by foot. That was true. And so when you tell me nobody wants to do that in the United States, I tell you, think again. This is an article from 2013 by a man called David Sirota, which is titled Hugo Chavez's Economic Miracle. For perspective, in 2013, when this article was published, inflation in Venezuela was over 50%. Over a million people had fled, and there were shortages in every grocery store. There was no food and medicine. I know it because I was there. And so if this man thinks that that's an economic miracle, then I can only guess he wants that miracle for the United States as well. Now you'd say, who cares who this man is and who cares about this magazine? Well, this man was the senior advisor and speechwriter for Bernie Sanders in the 2020 presidential campaign. Now, he's just one example. Let me give you another. This man is called Chesa Budin. He was until last year the district attorney of San Francisco, one of the largest cities in the United States. This is the man charged with the position that charges people for crimes. If you commit any crime in the city of San Francisco, this is the man who's supposed to charge you. Which in reality, what he did in his tenure was not charge people for crimes. And you wonder why. Well, these are two books he has authored. Venezuelan Revolution, 100 Questions and 100 Answers. And my favorite one, Gringo, A Coming of Age in Latin America. I mean, titles are really funny. I think it's hilarious. But this man is not funny. This man was the translator for Hugo Chavez. He was not just some gringo in Venezuela. He was not an American who was just enchanted by the revolution. He was working and getting paid by a human rights violator. And now he was a man charged with enforcing American laws in one of the most important cities. And not that he is to be blamed for the crimes of his parents, but his parents were both convicted terrorists too, by the way, who were in jail because they tried to kill people here in New York City. And so, yes, there are politicians who want to turn us into Venezuela and who admire them and then tell you the lie that they just want to turn us into Denmark. There's a national organization called the Democratic Socialists of America. They have hundreds of thousands of members, and they lie to the American students and young people by telling you that, you know, this is just about making up, redistributing income from the rich to the poor. Yet, when truth comes to light, they are meeting in Caracas with the dictator of Venezuela. This is a picture that they posted on their social media, meeting with Venezuelan dictator Nicolas Maduro and the first lady in 2021. And so the last thing that I want to tell you before we go to the Q&A is to debunk this myth that they tell you using that, you know, Daniel, nobody really wants to turn America into Venezuela. They just want to make us more like Denmark, Sweden, and Norway. And a lot of people say this with good intentions. They don't say it because they actually want to lie to you. But they're very misinformed about what the Nordic countries actually do to be so successful because these countries are right. They're very happy. They're very prosperous. They're very successful in many ways. And they live very long. So let's see. What do they do differently from the United States? And is what they do differently similar to what the socialists propose? Let's remember, what do the socialists in America want? They want higher taxes for the rich. They want more redistribution to the poor, and they want to, you know, increase spending and taxes for that. And they want to regulate companies more, right, to avoid greed and all these things. Well, all the Nordic countries have lower corporate taxes than the United States. That doesn't sound like a socialist thing to me, right? All the Nordic countries tax the average worker at a higher rate than the average worker in the United States. In other words, the supposedly socialist countries tax the workers more than the corporations in the United than in the United States. Sounds like we are the socialists, not them. And these countries also have very little debt. They balance their budgets really well. We do not. And I've never heard a socialist say that they want to balance the budget of the United States. I've only heard actually conservatives say that. And this is perhaps the most mind-blowing thing that I think a lot of people are not looking into. The United States, this is a paper that was published a couple of months ago in the American Economic Review, the most important American economic journal, okay, for scholarly literature. There is more redistribution by the government in the United States than in any European country. Yes, that is because the top 1% in the United States pay a similar share of their income in taxes to the government, to all levels of government, than in Western and Eastern Europe. In fact, they pay more than in Eastern Europe. But the poor in the United States pay much less in taxes than in any European country. And as a consequence, our tax system is much more progressive than Europe. Not just that, but our transfers, that is, the amount of money we give in welfare and social assistance to the poor, to the bottom half of our country, is a greater share of income in the United States than in any European country. And it's true. Norway is actually the European country that is at the top, right after the United Kingdom. But we redistribute more even than Norway. And so let me stop here before we go to questions. This is all to tell you guys. I lived through this, and this is the reason I began to study economics. And I care deeply about the United States, and I think you should too. And you should care deeply about any country that you live in. And there's a lot of people who are misguided by these ideas. I don't want anybody else to go through what I went through, to have to line up for hours for food, to not have gasoline, to not have electricity, to go from living like a middle-class family to go living like in extreme poverty. And that is what these policies cause. So let's have a good discussion. Let's have a debate about how we can improve America. But let's do it with the facts. And the facts is that socialism doesn't work.
Thank you so much for connecting with us on this. We've had a number of guest speakers discuss the dangers of socialism and the perils. I have some student questions and some teacher questions that were emailed to me, and I have some questions myself. You've been in America for a while. Do you see any parallels between how socialism was kind of implemented in Venezuela with what might be going on in our country, especially living in a place like New York? Or is like, were there certain red flags? Because it didn't just happen overnight. It was kind of a gradual thing. You mentioned about how they were voting in socialism. Are there certain things that you kind of see in the area of the country that you're at?
The biggest concern that I see is the politics of envy. So I see a demonization of profit. I see that politicians start to pit us against one another. In Venezuela, the rich are rich because the poor are poor. They do that here too. And here they use race and gender as well to pit people against one another. And that is all really a Marxist tactic of dividing and conquering. I think that the best antidote to the envy that politicians want to cause us, and this isn't just coming from the left, it comes from the right too, the use of envy and fear. We need to reject that and come from a place of gratitude. Gratitude for what we have, understanding that we are really a prosperous country and we can be better, but we have to read a little before we start with proposals to change things. You know, if you're going to say we need more redistribution because we don't redistribute anything at all, well, you're starting from a wrong fact. We redistribute more than any other country. Now, you may support more redistribution. That's still okay, but you have to understand we already do more than any other country. So what guarantees that it's going to lead to a different result if we do the same thing? So that's what concerns me, is envious of success. I think that what's made America stand apart from the rest of the world is that this is a culture that has promoted historically entrepreneurship and risk taking and drive for profit and those adventures. And if we lose that, then I'm not sure what makes us different anymore.
Sure. And we have a lot of kids who are in Spain and Italy here. So that was pretty cool that you had that in your heritage. So there's a lot of parallels there because they're considered Western society, Western culture as well. So we have a student question that a kid had emailed, and they wanted to know, do you know of any countries that went into socialism and were able to bounce back?
Yeah, I mean, many countries did so. Among them is Eastern Europe, right? And not just Eastern Europe, I'll talk in Latin America too, but in Eastern Europe, after the fall of the Soviet Union, Poland, the Czech Republic, Hungary, the Baltic countries, especially of Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania, are now really prosperous. It doesn't take a few years, it takes a couple of decades to go back to be really prosperous, but it can be done within one generation to go back to being a wealthy country. And I think Venezuela can do so too, and we have oil too, you know? So it goes both ways. If socialism didn't work in Venezuela, which had literally free money coming off the ground, it can't really work anywhere, right? But it also means that the recovery is going to be easier, I think, after it falls. And in Latin America, we saw the example in Chile. Actually, I recently went to Miami, and my Uber driver from the airport to the hotel was a man who spoke Spanish. But I couldn't quite pin his accent. And so I asked him, and he tells me that he's from Chile, but he didn't sound Chilean. That's why, I mean, the Chilean accent is very easily identifiable to me. And he tells me, but I lived for 30 years in Venezuela. He left Chile in 1973 after the socialist government of Salvador Allende had destroyed the economy of Chile within 3 years, led it to hyperinflation, just like in Venezuela. And he went to Venezuela when it was prosperous. Then he had to leave and come to America after everything went down in Venezuela the same way. But Chile, after 1973, when the military took over and the economic reforms that ensued, became the most prosperous country in Latin America. Today, Chile is like a developed country. There's Starbucks, there's Walmart, there's everything you can imagine. It's wealthier than even countries like Portugal in Europe. And that all happened because they applied the right policies in Chile.
One of the kids, they wanted to know, because we've seen you, I've seen you on the news, they've seen you on the news. What kind of advice would you have for us nowadays, being able to discern, because we hear fake news, real news? And I'm sure, and you can correct me, in Venezuela, when all of this was going down in the late 90s, early 2000s, how much of fake news played a part in creating that perfect storm for socialism to be segued into the government?
Yeah. Well, remember, I mean, Chavez took over after he had attempted a coup and gone to jail. Okay, like nobody should have voted for this man in the first place, regardless of their ideology, right? Because this was a criminal. This was somebody who did not believe in democracy from the start, but still enough people were deceived. I saw a quote. I was looking for old articles from the election when Chavez first won. This first election was actually legitimate, not like the ones that came later. But there was a man who supported Chavez who told the New York Times the day after the election, "We don't want a dictatorship. We only want change." And I laughed because they got a dictatorship as a result of his vote. And there was another man who was quoted who said, this is over. They're going to take our properties and socialism is coming. And I thought, wow, the other guy was fully, you know, he knew what was coming. And, you know, it shows that people can be deceived very easily. And it happens today. Something that I would recommend as you watch any news outlet is that news outlets have an agenda. If you are watching something on TV or reading an article, it's because they want you to watch it. Unfortunately, and I say this with a lot of regret, none of the major news channels are interested in actually exposing you to a debate or actually getting to the truth. They do not care about the truth, I am sorry to tell you. They only care about advising their viewpoint. And that's fine. I go on the news and I go to all the channels that would allow me to be there because I also care about advancing my viewpoint because I think it's the truth. But they will not have you if you're not advancing what they believe they want you to advance. It's a sad truth, which means that you need to expose yourself to as many different points of views as possible. That's the only way to get to the truth. And you need to research yourself. This happens a lot because, especially with economic news or with like things on immigration, I write about immigration a lot. That's what I do with the Manhattan Institute. There's so much misinformation because not only is that the outlets are mostly not interested in the truth, but the journalists are also not experts in what they're writing about. They're journalists. They're not economists. They're not sociologists. They're not physicians writing when they're writing about healthcare, right? When they're writing about viruses and things. They're none of that.
There's a lot going on, and that's, you know, the freedom of speech. And segueing to that, we'll go with a couple more questions, and then we'll let Daniel go because it's getting kind of late for some of our students around the world. But can you talk to the kids about some of the freedoms that we have here in America and the Western culture and the freedoms you guys did not have or they do not have currently in Venezuela?
Yeah, I mean, the biggest change really is safety. Venezuela became a very dangerous country under Chavez and Maduro. And, you know, Caracas, the city where I was from, is one of the cities with the highest murder rates on the planet. And so just being able to walk in the street, that's already a huge life quality improvement. And then in Venezuela, I mean, you said what rights we have. The truth is that in Venezuela, by our constitution, we had all the rights of the world because that's what socialists do. You have a right to healthcare, you have a right to education, you have a right to food, electricity, housing. But when everything is a right, nothing is. You know, if I tell you have a right to a computer, that is meaningless. You do not have a right to a computer. The truth is that rights are only what we are born with. And government's role, and you can see this was the purpose of creating the U.S. government in the Declaration of Independence. Government's role is to protect our inalienable rights that we're born with. And those rights are life. And then the property that we create throughout our life. So these things like, you may think that the government has a role in helping people, you know, in helping the poor, but that doesn't mean it's your right because we don't have the right to somebody else's labor, right? So the biggest difference was safety, was that we didn't really have all these rights that people are promised and that, you know, freedom of speech-wise, of course, we didn't have freedom of speech. You know, the government controlled all the media. The only thing we had was social media just because they were not smart enough to regulate it yet. There was no, you know, some people got in jail because they tweeted something. The government came to their houses. It's not a free country.
And I imagine that you probably wouldn't be welcome back. Given your public,
no, you know. Exactly, for sure. Yeah. Not just that, but like even if you're a Venezuelan who has no political involvement, they don't let you out unless you get a passport from the Venezuelan government, even if you have an honor citizenship, and you have to bribe them to get a passport, thousands of dollars in a country where the median salary is 100. So they're effectively making it illegal to leave. Which is why most Venezuelans are now leaving without a passport, walking by foot to Colombia. So, wow. So there's not really freedom of travel.
Wow. It's so hard to imagine, because that's what we have, you know, in Spain, Italy, France, America. I mean, we have just such a sense of normalcy, and it you know, by the stuff that you shared, I mean, it has just virtually changed overnight. Not overnight, but you know what I mean? Like, where
no, and, one and sense, Ralph, it's you just, know, the wow. most people, when they turn on the light or when they open the faucet to wash their hands, they don't think it twice. I think it twice. And I'm very happy that I'm able to do those things, because it's, you know, for some people, they never lived with those things. And so it's different. But when you already had those things and then you lose them, when you had electricity and then you lose it, when you had water and then you lose it, when you had food and then you lose it, that's perhaps worse. And so that's why the Venezuelan example is so critical, because if it can happen to Venezuela, it can happen to any country. Don't think that it can happen to you. That's what we were told. And it did happen.
It's still hard to wrap my head around. Definitely check out Dissident Project, guys. Check out DanielDeanMartino.com. Daniel, before we let you go, is there any imparting advice that you can give to these kids as they go off in the world? I know you're younger yourself, but you've lived multiple lifetimes in your short life. What kind of advice would you have for these kids?
Well, if any of you, you know, have any college questions or things like that, I'm also very happy to help you all. I went through that myself. So feel free to email me. I would argue just, okay, here I got it. So this is the Dissident thing, and this is my info. Ideas-wise, I would say the best thing you can do is to understand a little bit about economics. And I started reading when I was 12 years old, because I was so fascinated by the things that were happening around me. Fascinated is a word to describe it. and I started reading a book called Free to Choose by Milton Friedman. I highly recommend Free to Choose, the book, but I also highly recommend the TV show. There was a movie, a series on PBS, and it's all freely available on YouTube. Just write Free to Choose on YouTube and you'll find everything. And it's on all the languages you can imagine too. And that's also how I started learning English. It was very helpful. You learn so much about economics, incentives, all these things. That's what I would recommend.
That's wonderful. And Daniel, we can't thank you enough for joining us today. Before I end the meeting for all, we'll have a recording available for this for everybody. But before we end the meeting for all, can we all unmute and can we say thank you to Daniel for taking time out of his day to come talk to you guys about his story? Thank you so much, sir. We appreciate you. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.